Thank you. We'll call a meeting to order, and because of the rush last night, we missed the county attorneys. They wanted to object to portions of the PMAR bill, so I've agreed to let them put in a few minutes explaining their objections to the policy committee. Mr. Brown here is from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Dave Brown, and so go ahead, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here representing the County Attorneys Association, and I appreciate the fact that you don't have this bill back in front of you, and I apologize, I think, but I can explain our position pretty quickly. You heard the County Attorney Susan Gartner testify last night about Section 6, the Certificates of Good Conduct, and the County Attorneys Association supports that. It is the first section of that bill and the last section of that bill that we have concerns about. The first section of the bill, you will remember, expanded the use of 15218. That's the phase of adjudication for drug offenses. Expands the kinds of cases that it applies to, and it turns it from something that the judge can do to something the judge shall do unless they make specific findings. And here are concerns with that, and we wanted to get those on the record, and I appreciate that Representative Paymar indicated last night a willingness to work on this section, and we will be working with him on that. But with regard to Section 1 and the 15218, you'll notice in the laws that exist now, it does not apply or exclude robberies or sexual assaults or domestic assaults or prior. So somebody who has a prior conviction that can still get a stay of adjudication here. And I heard last night Mr. Stewart from the Public Defender's Office indicate, well, the judge could always come back and say, well, that's a substantial and compelling reason not to give this. I disagree with that. I don't think that's an accurate legal assessment. The term substantial and compelling is actually a term of art for lawyers, and particularly for appellate lawyers like myself. And it requires something, and since you have in the bill now that those kinds of convictions don't disqualify somebody, and you didn't change any of that language, a court would more than likely find that those kinds of convictions would continue to not exclude somebody. I'm not sure that's the intent here. Secondly, fifth degree applies not just to low-level offenses, to kids or person with a very, very small amount of drugs, but up to 10 kilos of marijuana. And so we have large grow operations that are still continue to be considered fifth degree drugs, but may not be appropriate for a 15218 disposition. And to say that the court shall do that unless they make, again, this term of art, substantial and compelling reasons, puts courts at a disadvantage. Give you some context. Hennepin County handled 1,150 fifth degree cases. And in Hennepin County, we actually give a bigger break to drug defendants in a number of cases than outstate or other counties. We have drug court, we have drug diversion, and we have 15218. But I will tell you that if you change the standard by which judges from the fact that they may give 15218 to they shall do it unless, I would anticipate that a number of our prosecutors in a number of our cases may not be willing to give diversion as the first outset, since they know if the person screws up, the legislation says the court shall. And so we'll be addressing those concerns with Representative Paymar. But those are some of the unforeseen consequences, and because we in Hennepin County are such a large county, you may be trying to benefit, and I greatly appreciate that outstate, some people are not getting any of these diversion tools. And I think that's something that can be addressed, but we think that's something that can be addressed in this drug working group that you're putting together, where everybody can get together and we can figure out how to get them diversion, but without adversely impacting a county that does so many like ours. And I think that would have a great deal. So, and as to the last section, the repealer on an early conditional release for low-level drug offenders who get treatment, that's also something that can be referred to the working group. And the fix to that isn't to repeal the sunset clause, but we believe to simply move it back. The whole reason apparently for wanting to repeal that was because the Department of Corrections wanted to be able to keep putting people in through next legislative session. They wouldn't be able to do that. Move it back another 6 months and you will let them do that. The drug working group can get together, figure out how we can change the drug laws in a way that works for everyone and come back with recommendations on the 152.18, early conditional release, and all of the other mandates in that fit.
Okay,
so thank you, Mr. Chair, very much for the opportunity to put those concerns on the record.
Okay, then we're going to move to somebody. Somebody has to move to reconsider our motion on House File 3474. These are ones that Commerce decided they didn't want after they had demanded them. So the other night we passed them there. And Representative Lilly was our liaison with his committee and straightened it out. So would somebody move to reconsider 3474, the action?
I'll also move, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Now, Representative Kalin, would you move to send that bill, does this go anywhere, directly to the floor? Directly to the, refer it to the floor.
The general registers.
Sure. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. You want to be the next? Do you want to move all of them? Okay.
Sure. Might even be able to remind. These are all the foreclosures.
There's bills. Three of them. There's a couple more. They haven't decided what to do just yet.
Would you be willing just to do four or five words on what each of the bills do?
The first one was the. They were all ones passed the other night. The first one was.
Or even just the author was.
The notice of sale. That was the Hillstrom bill.
Okay.
This is a Coles bill regarding certain notices to tenants.
Yes. I'll move that we reconsider. What's the number?
3476.
Can we reconsider 3476?
76.
76, excuse me.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries, no. Representative.
Move that we recommend a pass and send to the general register 3476.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. The next one is 3516, and it's the Dabney bill setting up data practices and adding a few things that have to be on the mortgage.
Oh, yes. I'll move to reconsider 3516.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
I'll move that we send House File 3516, recommend it pass, and send it to the general register.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Kalin, you're really on a roll this morning.
I tell you. Two cups of coffee.
The first bill we're going to take up is the Representative Thiessen's genetic handling information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And does somebody want to move the bill? Representative Paymar moves House File 3438, and Representative Thiessen, is this your amendment to get it in the shape you want?
Yes. The 1263, is that
right? Yes. Representative Paymar, do you want to move the 1263? Representative Paymar moves the 1263 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Thiessen, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. This bill relates to newborn screening, and under current law and a law we've had in place for several years, when a baby is born, their test a small sample of blood is taken from them to test for several diseases that are congenital diseases, basically, but that are treatable if you catch them early. And I think that's a really important point to make here, is that these are things you wouldn't know if you didn't do the testing, but if you test and find out that there's a positive test, you can do treatment and prevent some really bad things from happening. And one of the reasons I'm carrying this bill is that when my third kid, my son, was born, he was born in July of 2003, and in May, the Department of Health had added a number of tests to their screening mechanism, and he was actually screened and tested positive for a condition. And it was a condition that we would have not known anything about it. We didn't know that we were carriers of it. And it's something that had we not found out about it, he would have very likely gotten very sick and in a really dangerous situation. Because of the screening, we caught it, and were able to treat it, and he's, you know, does great. It's kind of become largely a non-event. And I think, but the point is that these are things that people don't know about. You don't know in advance that they're there, and they save a lot of lives and save a lot of human tragedies. And so what this bill does, the reason this bill is before you is the legislature back in 2006 passed a bill by Representative Kahn that did some stuff with genetic testing. And as an unintended consequence, this newborn screening got caught up in it. So really what we're doing in this bill is to say that the rules we specifically set up for newborn screening govern newborn screening as opposed to the general genetic testing statute. And because there were concerns that Representative Holberg and others have raised over the period of time, and not unreasonable concerns about providing information to parents about this testing in a very clear way so people can make informed decisions, we've actually gone back, I mean, the health department, largely with Representative Holberg involved in the discussions, and I think Representative Simon was involved in some of those discussions, to talk about what kind of disclosures need to be made to people so that it's consistent with the law. So that really is what this bill is trying to accomplish. And I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers briefly if we could to explain more.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here. I am Dr. Joanne Barkis. I'm the relatively newly appointed director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health. And with me is Mr. Mark McCann, the manager of the newborn screening program. As I mentioned, I'm delighted to be here to talk about this incredibly important program. As Representative Thiessen mentioned, the Minnesota Department of Health screens approximately 73,000 infants each year for 53 different rare and serious medical conditions. And as has been mentioned, diagnosis and treatment soon after birth can make the difference between a healthy, happy child and either a disabled or even a death, can result in death. This newborn screening is covered under Minnesota Statute 144.125, which requires that all infants be tested shortly after birth. This statute also states that parents must be informed that they may decline the testing, that blood samples may be retained by MDH after testing, and that the parents should be informed of the benefits of retention of tissues and blood samples. And it also requires that we inform parents that they may have a testing, but that the results of the test and the blood samples may be destroyed within 24 months of testing. As has already been mentioned, the Genetic Privacy Statute 13386 that passed in 2006 conflicts with MS 144.125 and requires that a written informed consent for use of the blood samples other than for direct testing be obtained and also for storage of the sample. We are proposing changes to both of these statutes to clarify that newborn screening is covered under MS 144.125 and to, as has been mentioned, to strengthen the language in requiring us to inform parents of their different options, to include some additional options, and to strengthen this information. What I'm going to do now is turn this over to Mr. McCann, who will provide you with some specifics of the proposed changes.
Mr. McCann.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'm Mark McCann, Program Manager with the Minnesota Department of Health Newborn Screening Program. Just a very quick overview, and I don't have much to add that Representative Thiessen hasn't already covered, that this particular bill patches essentially conflict between Chapter 13 and Chapter 144. It enhances and really clarifies the agency's roles and I think birthing care providers' roles in communicating parental rights in terms of their ability to opt out of testing, meaning it strengthens informed participation. And it requires us to come back to you folks in early January of next year to report on progress made by this newborn screening program. I do want to thank you folks on the wisdom of the legislative body. Historically, in 2003, a very large fee increase and expansion of the program had arose, and with the blessing of the legislature, I'm happy to report that Minnesota is now in a leadership role with the number of tests offered. Out of the 53 conditions that are currently tested for from these live blood spots, it's about 150 children per year with a saved life or a greatly improved medical outcome. These are hidden, rare, very silent disorders that clinicians don't know about, can't see, can't clinically detect without some additional level of testing. That's what all I have to say, folks.
Is that all representation?
That,
okay. I believe Ms. Brace, I think you said last night you were going to testify on this.
Okay.
Mr. Brace. Chair, members of the committee, I do have a handout if someone would like to pass it out.
Ms. Brace, state your name for the record.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and this has been an issue of our concern for a long time. In 2003, as a result of our efforts, we got parents opt out. However, it's only an objection. So if they object, they get to opt out, but they weren't actually being told of the right to object. And so we had parents calling us up trying to object at the hospital and actually not being given information that allowed them to do so. Hospitals, in fact, didn't even know what was happening. So the bill before you proposes to exempt the newborn genetic testing program from the state genetic privacy law. It does not require parents to be fully informed prior to testing any more than the 2003 law did, and it does not require actual consent. In addition, the bill is notable for what is not in the bill, including the fact that the health department has claimed the DNA of at least 700,000 children as government property without any legal authority to do so or without parent consent. The fact that newborn blood has been given to researchers without the knowledge or the consent of parents, and the fact that the health department is identifying not only children, but parent carriers of genetic traits through the screening program. Last Friday at the University of Minnesota at a neurogenomics conference, after the department announced the fact that they are doing this, Dr. Ellen Clayton Wright, director of the Bioethics Center at Vanderbilt University, made a point of saying in the middle of her speech that they made sure that that was not done in Tennessee. Let me be clear, newborn screening belongs in the genetic privacy law. According to Dr. Jeff Botkin in pediatrics, newborn screening represents, quote, the largest single application of genetic testing in medicine. Nancy Green at the March of Dimes writes that newborn screening is, quote, the first population-wide genetic testing program, end quote. Yet the Department of Health seeks to exempt it and the retention and government use and dissemination of every child's blood and genetic information from the state's genetic privacy law and its written, informed consent requirements. The Health Department also wants to continue to do unconsented research on the children of Minnesota. Today, Minnesota tests every child for 54 conditions despite the fact that the final report of the U.S. Task Force on Genetic Testing challenges the assertion that newborn screening is as necessary and valuable as proponents say. Dr. Diane Paul, author of the report's history of PKU screening, notes the following about the expansion of conditions for which children are tested. Some of the tests are not disordered at all, but normal biochemical variants. Many of these tests have uncertain magnitude of benefit and were, quote, added casually with little systematic assessment of their value and risk, and also with little concern for obtaining informed consent, end quote. Some of these newborn screen tests, he said, were in effect research programs which did not allow for consent on the part of the subject's guardians. In line with Dr. Paul's statements, Dr. Norman Faust, who participated in the only randomized clinical trial in newborn testing, warned the President's Council on Bioethics in 2002 about the dangers of expanding the conditions for which newborns are tested, saying, so, we now already have many states, including Wisconsin, that does routine testing without consent, without prior research, for dozens of conditions using tandem mass spectrometry. And I predict, unless there are some dramatic change in the way we think about these things, the way we do these things, that multi-array DNA testing will occur within the next few years, as soon as the cost comes down.
To me, this is a calamity involving every child in America. The amount of harm, psychological harm, that will occur to families and children, not to mention medical harm, is, in my view, going to be extensive. In the Journal of Medical Ethics, one expert said that DNA sequencing is coming soon. Earlier than expected, even by most experts, the DNA chip appears to overcome the technical limitations of genetic mass screening through the synthesis of computer and DNA technologies. So already, newborn screening is not without its risk to the public. Children and families can be harmed by newborn screening, including long-term anxiety related to false positive results, finding out genetic propensities you and your family didn't want to know about, questions of paternity, placement of genetic test results, including mere traits, into a permanent and increasingly public medical record, genetic profiling, social stigma, and the loss of access to employment and insurance based on what your genes say might happen to you. In addition, the child is precluded from making a choice about genetic testing. And finally, in the case of the department claiming newborn DNA as state property, the child loses his genetic privacy and property rights. It's important to note that because the health department made a decision 10 years ago to lay claim to the DNA of our children, neither the public or the legislature have discussed this executive decision or the potential and far-reaching consequences of government ownership of citizen DNA. This bill attempts to circumvent any such discussion, presuming on state ownership continuing into the future. Here's the bottom line. Newborn screening is not yet a scientifically proven endeavor, yet the newborn screening law makes it difficult for Minnesota families to protect their children from this medical research. After detailing a rather dark history of PKU testing, which includes death, retardation, and severe malnutrition of perfectly healthy children that had a false positive, as well as more children born with mental retardation, Dr. Paul writes the following in the U.S. Genetic Task Force report about today's drive to test. Quote, a technological imperative has combined with unrealistic assumptions about the benefits of newborn screening, and that drives the expansion of screening programs. The lesson that such wholesale expansion is unwarranted has been repeatedly drawn since the early 1960s. Surely it is time to heed it. So every day in Minnesota, there are about 200 children whose blood is taken and whose blood is entered into the department's biobank, genomic biobank. And the information that I handed out to you is the history of what has happened in this program and the fact that there are now 1.4 million children who are registered with their genetic test results. And the number of test results are increasing. In addition, there's about 700,000 children whose blood and DNA are considered state property in a database that the government holds. There's nothing in this bill to discuss that. And what we would like to see is that there would be consent, real informed consent, not dissent, because dissent means that you don't have to inform them. If they know that they can object, you can tell them they have an opt-out. But if you don't actually tell them in the fog of the delivery of a child, in all of that hassled and harried environment, that they need to look at this sheet, they need to see that this is the government doing the testing, they need to understand that the government's collecting the blood and doing research on their children without their consent. In the midst of having a child, if you do not tell them, hand them the sheet, and give them the right to consent to that, then you have not really given them the rights at all. And DNA testing is going to lead to children and families being told things about themselves they don't want. And when the government holds their blood, the legislature can come back any time in the future, and they can decide to test all those children for something else. So I would ask that there would be real consent for the newborn program. I would ask that an oral Tennyson warning be required to be given, and the parents be informed that this is genetic testing, not just the PKU, but genetic testing. And as Dr. Ellen Clayton Wright wrote once, no physician would dream of doing this without talking about it in their office. But that's what's happening today. And then I would ask that the state DNA warehouse be dismantled. None of these parents have been asked, and none of them have given consent. And yet their data has been used already, some of them for four research projects.
We're going to have to.
So thank you very much for your time.
Twice as much time as the other Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, Ms. Grace, a number of us were involved in this with the data practices bill last year. And as a result of the logjam, nothing happened last year. And I'm glad to see that apparently a compromise has is before us. But doesn't this really come down from your standpoint to whether or not there's an opt-in or an opt-out? Isn't that basically what you're talking about? In other words, you want an opt-in. You want parents to have to affirmatively say, yes, you may, rather than a presumptive yes and giving them opt-out. Isn't that really what this is about? You want an opt-in, and others want an opt-out.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, that is correct, because an opt-in is the only way that we can guarantee that parents will be informed. An opt-out is what we have had for 4 years, and there have been parents that have come to testify before this legislature and have talked about the fact that hospitals never told them. They didn't know, and as a matter of fact, their baby was just like taken one morning and returned with a band-aid on their heel. All the time while there was a law allowing them to opt out, but they don't have to be told about it.
Thanks. Obviously, the person that I deferred to on this was Representative Holberg, and what impressed me is that her name is on the bill. She's no softie on this issue, and as you know, and if these opt-out protections are specific enough and good enough for her, that's telling to me. She can speak for herself, but...
Representative Holberg, well, the softie.
I'm not a softie. By a long shot. And thank you for that question, Representative Simon. I'm still a big supporter of opt-in. I believe that that's what we should be doing. We have parents sign consent for immunization. As I was telling Representative Emmer, and this will probably fall into the too much information category, but I had to sign a consent for my husband's vasectomy. Hello? Yes. You know? I'm just saying that this is a situation where we are going to hold as a state genetic material. That being said, I feel passionately about it. I'm a realist. And that the language that is in the bill provides for opting out of research, a right that parents didn't have before. Before it was a Sophie's choice, in that if you had the testing done, you had to allow for the samples to be allowed for research as well. So, yeah, I put my name on the bill to try and break the logjam, but I'm very passionate about the fact that, you know, I think the parents should know about this. And, Representative Thiessen, he feels just as passionately the other way. I try to understand his position. I don't believe that when parents are informed of this, that they're going to say no. I believe that just as many people are going to have the test, but then they're going to know about their options. Representative Thiessen disagrees. He thinks that it will harm babies, et cetera. But my name is on the bill because it breaks the logjam for last year. Do I think this is the ultimate solution or what the citizens of Minnesota deserve relative to this issue? No.
Representative Thiessen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's important that we're clear about something. And in fact, people are provided information, and that's what this bill actually says. That they have to be provided with a written document explaining all this stuff, and then giving them the chance to opt out.
And
there's a very specific reason that there's an opt out instead of an opt in, because this, and maybe we can have the Department of Health come back up and respond to some of Ms. Brady's thing. I think that would be fair, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, when I talked to the rep from the Health Department, I said that when in committee that I was going to put a bunch of stuff on the record, because quite frankly, I'm a big skeptic. And their ability to meet the expectations of the legislature relative to providing information to parents has been very, very inadequate in the past. They have assured me that they're going to do things different, and that's why I said, well, we'll have a conversation on the record in committee and put some things on the record, because when they come back next year, if they haven't stepped to those levels, then I think, we're going to have to do something.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg and others, thanks for the accountability check. We are accountable. We want to operate a very transparent program as well. Since 2003, with the legislative wisdom that was put forth of a fee increase, we finally had active health education as it pertained to newborn screening. Immediate changes were made to enhance informed participation in the realm of opt-out consent. Looking at that period for about the first 2 years of the changes that we made, web-based as well as hard copy in services, medical doctor training, nurse training, any way, shape, or form you could really try to do it to try to get the message to the sick, I didn't think we were doing a good enough job. To date, we've gone through actually three revisions now. We continue, and I think there is a representative forward for holding me accountable. It's helped calibrate some of my thinking and some of the application. We have had, from an agency perspective, the largest public health outreach for health education, period. These are examples of three brochures. It informs parents about research. It informs parents about newborn screening. It informs parents about their rights to decline testing. It's informed participation, and it works, and works quite well. Available in Spanish, and also uniquely for those, I've never heard anyone have a voice for them, the Amish. I mean, we actually actively educate about rights here in Minnesota.
Is there a scale on?
Jim Lund, Representative Simon. I think Representative Simon's on this particular issue, and I have another comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to put in perspective what you said, Representative Holbrook. I mean, I was last year impressed with the argument that what was handed out, when you look at the actual document, is basically was at that point a glossy brochure among many glossy brochures that new parents get at the hospital, and the content was pretty thin. And I agreed with you there. Even though I don't support an opt-in, I supported what I'm seeing in the field now, which is a much more beefed up opt-out, where there's more information, where people know their rights. So, I mean, I'd want to maybe see the layout of what this document would look like, you know, from a graphic standpoint, but I'm personally satisfied with what's in this bill. I don't go as far as you in wanting an opt-in, but this seems to be a much more substantial opt-out that's good enough for me at this point, but... I just want to put that in perspective, because you were right, I think, last year, that it was pretty thin, and that a new parent would really not have all the information that they needed.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair and Representative, forward thinking, the Minnesota Department of Health Newborn Screening Program, and I gave Mary Representative Holberg credit for helping calibrate my thinking on this one, but we've created a separate and distinct, and it's the first of its kind in the nation, communication and education unit within the program. It's soon to be staffed with some good health education leadership, with additions of our genetic counseling staff and audiologic staff. We're going to better than ever get the health message out. Now, more importantly, where we're going, and I think what we've done here, this is an in-the-nursery piece that is pretty effective. We're doing a much better job, the forward thinking as well. Prenatal education has got to happen here in Minnesota. Nobody nationally, even European countries, are doing it and sustaining it. We've got the resources to start it up here in Minnesota and hopefully sustain it and knock it out for the long term. In addition to that, general education, we need to get that on the table.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering about the people that come in that are low educational skills or illiterate or whatever. Do you have the staff to explain these kind of things to them? I mean, the non-English speakers, Spanish is fine, but there's dozens of other languages. Are you going to have interpreters and educators? And I just kind of think in all the hubbub of what's going on in the hospital and trying to explain that to somebody, having really apprehend what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, in terms of active health education, no, we do not have that. We do mention it in our brochures and our education materials, as we do in services with the hospital-based staff and breathing care providers, including of recent birth care educators. We do have within the agency, and it is available. It's rarely used, though. You can hold us accountable in terms of the effectiveness then of our message, but we do have interpretive services available. One thing we're looking at forward thinking as well to really get the message out, web-based, little podcasts for the multiple languages that are available.
Representative Kalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cornish, I'm glad you asked the question. My wife is an OB and just finished her residency last June at HCM, through the University of Minnesota, but the two most frequent in hospitals are HCMC and Regions, where I think that she may have seen patients who speak something in the neighborhood of 25 different languages over the course of her 4 years. I want to first comment on your question and then actually comment on something that Ms. Brave brought up. One of the things that I think we do need to do is actually make it easier for accredit interpreters, because there are often people in the hospital who can speak a language and have enough medical knowledge, but have to go through a pretty rigorous process to then become, I can't remember if it's licensed or accredited interpreter. It can be Spanish, it can be any number of languages, but to the point that Ms. Gray raised earlier, I want to speak very quickly to the rigorous standards for informed consent for physicians. There are incredibly rigorous professional standards and ethical standards to provide true informed consent. I think the additional requirements of specific advisory in the of options and rights in the bill is a very good thing, and I appreciate Representative Fulberg being willing to come partway and Representative Thiessen to accommodate those as well to break this logjam. But just to Representative Cornish's point, a couple of nights ago, well, over the last 3 weeks, a Somali woman who was scheduled for a C-section wouldn't show up. It was a ninth child, wouldn't show up. Four or five times they scheduled the C-section. She wouldn't show up. And finally, her emergent delivery happened when my wife was on call. Her family, because my wife does such a thorough informed consent, it took her longer to do so because she very carefully explained all the risks, as physicians do and should do. The procedure went well, of course, and afterward, the family, who totally disgusted her, is now like chasing her down the hall to give her hugs and say thank you, and that's what physicians do. And so to suggest that even in the fog of birth, as the phrase is used, it can be quite, I have not experienced it yet myself, but certainly, I think Representative Rush went through it, but, yeah. Oh, I did experience it once, but I didn't have cognitive abilities, like maybe a little bit less than I did now. Representative Emmer might disagree, but, I just want to make that point that physicians do a wonderful job of providing informed consent, and to suggest otherwise, I think, really doesn't do justice to the medical education or to the field in general. And I think we have to be very, very careful about saying the department's burden is to do all this education when really the physicians are and the providers are the ones doing so.
Mr. Chairman, I respond.
Ms. Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kalin. Thank you very much for that. And I do believe that it is the doctor that should be the one giving informed consent for newborn screening. As it is often the laboratory technician that just comes in and takes the child or comes in and doesn't have the answers for the questions. And so the department should be building up an entire education division, when what we could do is have the people who are closest to the child and to the family and have the requirement for consent. The requirement for consent makes sure the education happens. A dissent requirement doesn't, and it just leaves it sort of up there, and maybe the department can get resources or not, maybe they'll reach the right people or not. That's not for sure. But thank you, because I do think the doctors do a great job with consent.
We're going to follow up, Mr. Chair, and I know that we want to get moving, but just that this notion of opt-in or opt-out actually really requires informed consent either way. And so I think actually the point that Representative Simon raised really, and I see Representative Holbrook disagrees with me, but I do think that it needs to be an informed decision either way, and that is what matters the most. And that's why I think that the elements added to this bill really will help to advance that conversation.
Members, we're going to have to start not quite talking quite as much. We're going to end these bills today, and we still have three amendments yet on this bill, so to discuss. Representative Saylor and then Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably this would be to the Department of Health folks. I'm just wondering, you mentioned a little bit about prenatal information. It just occurs to me that when we're talking about the fog of birth and all this sort of thing, you know, and the pressures immediately after the baby is born, it would seem that it would be useful to have a great deal of information presented prior to that. One kind of assumes that you're going to need to know that, you know, in the next few weeks or so. when you're in for those prenatal. So I'm just wondering, I didn't hear a great deal about that, and I thought that since probably the majority of people going in to have babies do have prenatal care, not all, but could you just say how much you're addressing that earlier on?
Mr. McCann.
Mr. Chair and Representative, in terms of active prenatal education right now in the state of Minnesota, we are doing it in the form of outreach opportunities right now with birth educators, getting them on board to use actually this material to educate parents about it. It's moving forward. We've had some pushback on the OBGYN community a bit. They feel overly taxed, don't have the release time, etc. So we've got a little bit of politicking to do to really get the buy-in with a sustainable prenatal education effort. And I think the development of some of the additional tools, we recognize as well, it's, I think, a very good time to get the majority of parents well-informed and become active, informed participants for opt-out consent.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions because this is an issue that has bothered me for a couple of years, and I see it differently, obviously, than Representative Thiessen and some others. But in listening to Representative Kalin, it actually struck me that he has an interesting viewpoint because he's got a wife who practices in the area. And I'm wondering, I've got probably a half a dozen questions for you folks, but Representative Kalin, your wife does this delivery. What exactly, if you think it's informed consent, what exactly did she tell this Somali woman about her rights when it comes to genetic testing and research?
Representative Kalin. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Emmer. We didn't have this specific conversation about that specific patient and genetic testing, but I do know that that she and all the colleagues that she worked with work extremely hard to always provide true informed consent, and it's actually been an issue for the AMA over the last decade to continue to increase the vigilance and the thoroughness of that, of every conversation about every procedure, to get true informed consent.
So you don't know what she told the Somali lady about this informed consent, this genetic testing. This, Mr. Chairman, is for the Ms. Braze. You testified that there are 1.4 million samples that have been collected. I don't understand where you're getting that from. And when you say collected, are those collected and stored? Can you give us some more information?
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, actually it is that there are around 700,000 samples, blood samples and DNA, the blood samples and DNA of 700,000 children are now being held by the health department. It's considered government property. That information comes from the department, and the 1.4 million number is the number of children whose names and information and their genetic testing results are in a database at the Department of Health, and that also comes from the department.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Braze, you gave us this handout that goes back to 1965. Can you give us that time frame for the number, the 1.4 million number? How long has it taken to collect that?
Mr. Chair, according to the department, they started collecting the testing results and keeping them in 1986, I believe, and then they started keeping the blood in 1997. And both of those were done without legislative authority, without any rule of law. It was just an executive decision on the department.
Mr. Chairman, this would be not for Mr. McCann, but it's Dr.
Barkus
with a B?
B-A-R-T-Z.
Thank you. You had testified 53 conditions are tested and that tissues and blood samples are taken. Was that a misstatement or?
That's what the 144.125 specifies blood and tissues, although we actually, I believe, collect only blood.
Mr. Chairman?
This is November.
Thank you, Dr. Barkus. Where do you keep these samples? I heard Ms. Braze talk about a warehouse that she wants dismantled. Where are these things stored?
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, samples are stored at the Minnesota Department of Health in a very secure location, three levels of proximity access to access it, up to the year of 2004. 1996. Prior to that, they are archived through a process and stored, and I can't even access them without going through some incredible hoops with the Minnesota Historical Society, where the Minnesota Archive is. So those are at room temperature. The ones in the laboratory are currently securely frozen.
Chairman, and then either Mr. McCann or Dr. Barkas. Dr. Barkas, you had testified that samples and tissue may be destroyed within 24 months. How long or how far back do these samples that are archived go?
The residual dry blood spot specimens go back, or sorry for the formality, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, the archived samples and specimens go back to July of 1997.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Emmer, can we start to wind down a little bit here so we can get to your amendments and things?
I will do my best. This, and I apologize, Mr. Chairman, but this is a very important issue to me, and I'll tell you, I've got a question that's coming from Representative Thiessen, because I've gone through this process a few times as a participant and an observer, and I can tell you that anybody who wants to tell me that as you're either juggling other children and trying to haul mom back and forth from the hospital and get her set up in the room, and they throw more paper at you in addition to breastfeeding material and everything else you can think of. And for somebody to tell me that they explain, or it does me a service by explaining to me what my rights are with respect to genetic material that belongs to my family or my children, it doesn't make sense. So, two questions.
Representative, I think,
and I'll be done.
We're kind of down to, I think, I didn't understand all of the complications of this initially, but I think we pretty much understand the two sides and how they feel, and we're kind of going over the same thing over and over, but go ahead, Representative.
Are you suggesting that maybe the outcome is already...
I have no idea how anybody's going to vote on this.
Well, I'll give up if you want me to give up. I'm just trying to make a point.
No.
What about the testing, Mr. Chairman? And this is for Mr. McCann or Dr. Barkas. How far back does the testing go?
Mr. McCann?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, test result data electronically stored in archives goes back to 1986.
All right. Mr. Chair, and I'll short-circuit it. Representative Thiessen, this is a disagreement that I've had with you over the last couple of years. You're here today because there was a law that was passed on genetic testing that required written, informed consent. And I'm not talking about this mixing of words about, well, we're going to inform you, so then you're going to consent not to opt out. That's not informed consent. Consent is, here's your choice. Here's the information. You decide if you want it or not. I agree with Representative Holberg, and frankly, whether you believe it or not, I agree with you. I think these tests are that important that if I were given the opportunity, I would opt in. But I don't think you're doing people a service when we at the legislature decide that it's so important for them, they're going to have to figure it out to opt out. Why would you think that the genetic testing requires the written consent in the form that it's provided, but this would not? In other words, this would provide the opt-in as opposed to the opt-out.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. McCann can also go into this, there's a couple of reasons. The first one is that, you know, that I think that there's being a picture painted here that people are going to go out and do all kinds of genetic testing on kids. I think there's kind of a scare tactic going on a little bit. And what this is really about, it's just a few things. It's to find out if the child has the problem that are hidden and people don't know about. Okay. So first of all, the reason it's an opt-in versus an opt-out is because some people may think, well, I don't need to do that because I know I don't have any, I'm not carrying any genetic problems myself. And in fact, from personal experience, I know that that's the case because I would have never known that. And my son would have probably gotten very sick or died as a result because... And there's people, and I probably would have opted in as well, just because of that. But there's a lot of people that may not have, because they didn't know what's in, you know, what they're carrying themselves that they're passing on to their children. The second thing is that in order to make sure these tests act correctly and we avoid the false positive that Ms. Braves was talking about, in order to make sure that the scientific validity of these tests is correct, that's why we need a robust set of this information. It's not that we're going to go, that the department goes back in and it's going to start pulling out other genetic data. It's to make sure that these tests work correctly. And I think Mr. McCann can, I think it's worth spending just a minute here to explain really that piece.
Well, very quickly, because we're going to...
No, very quickly, but I think...
We're going to go to amendments very quickly.
No, I...
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, one thing that I'd like to comment on with regard to the opt-out consent is that it does provide a safety net for a lot of the reasons that you've mentioned as concerns. People are hairy, nurses are busy, things happen, and the consequences of not realizing that you could opt out are that your child gets tested, and that afterwards you can request that the test results and the sample be destroyed. The consequences of missing an opt-in opportunity can be devastating. So we believe this is provides a better safety net for the infant, and that there is the opportunity to correct it afterwards if necessary.
Okay. We're going to go to amendments. Representative Emmer, I think you have three, don't you?
Mr. Chair, yeah. I still haven't had my opportunity to put these points on the record, and I know you want to move things along, but, you know, this is a really important issue, and if not next year, 5 years, 10 years, when the state wakes up and realizes that the state of Minnesota has genetic material on all those young people.
Can you do this very quickly? Because it seems to me we're going over, expanding the exact same thing over and over and over and over. So if you can quickly do it. I mean, I think it's an important issue, but I think to say the same thing over and over is...
Well, I think some things need to be put on the record.
Okay.
Number one, I would take issue with Representative Thiessen's comments about this being inadvertently being included in the genetic information. That when the CON bill was passed relative to genetic information, the group did not differentiate genetic information except for the newborn screening. What they said is when the state's going to collect genetic information, it should adhere to these standards. And that's the way the judge interpreted it. So there never was any intent of the genetic information working group's recommendation to exempt the newborn screening when that language was worked on and passed. I think the health department probably missed it and didn't know they were going to get caught in the whirlwind. But there's been no differentiation between newborn screening, genetic information, and other genetic information. Trying to come to some type of resolution. The doctor talked about missing the opt-in opportunity. Well, they don't miss the opportunity to take the blood. They find the time to take the blood. And if they can find the time to take the blood, they can find the time to inform the parent. Plain and simple. Now, Mr. McCann, what type of document are you planning on providing to parents to give them this important information?
Mr. McCann.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, we have one example of that before you. I think soon to be developed prenatal as well as general educational tool, as well as additional in-servicing. Hospitals do make business decisions on their own in terms of implementation and communication of that message.
And Mr. McCann, you and I have had this conversation about how a nice little yellow fluffy brochure doesn't cut it when we're talking about something so important. I mean, I am hoping that when you go to these parents, it's a piece of paper that looks like an important document that they have, that's given to them, and that there's some record of them having received it. And so, you know, your little brochures are really cute, and they go in a stack of things with Similac coupons and coupons for various baby magazines, etc. But I think that if the health department is really serious about informing parents about this, their form should look serious and not nice and fluffy. And also in looking at this, and I'm trying to move as quickly as I can, Mr. Chair, but I, quite frankly, have been working on this for 5 years, have had little to no success with the health department moving in for the reasonable information process with parents. And in the discussion today, I'm looking at the bill. I have become very concerned about the terms using specimens and tissue, and it was never my intent to allow any type of tissue collection to occur under this genetic testing. And I'm wondering if you would consider a friendly amendment on page 1, line 22, after the second "and" and before the word "specimens" to insert the word "blood."
Representative Houston.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, I can't incorporate.
Representative, do you want to make the motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd move to insert the word "blood" on page 1, line 22, after the second "and" before the word "specimen."
Is there any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Representative Holberg, can you have any...
Mr. Chair, I'll just...
Can we go through that?
Out of respect and time, but
thank you.
Not
Representative Emmer, present the amendments fairly quickly.
Very quickly. The first one, the A5 amendment, is the one I'd like to start with. I believe I'm doing it in the right order. The A5 amendment, and Matt, please help me if I do this wrong, but the A5 amendment is the actual consent provision which would change the law, Representative Peason. It would change it from an opt-out to an opt-in, in effect. Did I do that one right, Matt?
Mr. Chair, the A5 amendment is the one that,
Mr. Gearing,
that in effect... requires that the document given to parents before testing be a Tennyson warning.
Oh, hold on.
So,
the A4 amendment is those.
I got to put them in.
A1 says.
I'm sorry, I did it wrong. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to do the A4. That's the first one.
Okay. Representative Emmer moves the A4 amendment.
Yeah, let's do that one. We're doing them out of order. I've got them all mixed up. The one that I just described is the A4. It's self-explanatory. Before the test results or samples can be used for any studies or research, the parents of the infant must be allowed to provide. They must be given a Tennyson warning. And for those of you that aren't familiar with it, under 1304 Subdivision 2, an individual asked to supply private or confidential data concerning the individual shall be informed of, 1, the purpose and intended use of the requested data, 2, whether the individual may refuse or is legally required to supply the data, 3, any known consequences arising from supplying or refusing to supply the data, and 4, the identity of other persons or entities authorized by state or federal law to receive the data. And I'd ask for a roll call.
Any discussion? Representative,
I oppose the amendment. Two things quickly. First of all, this will undermine our ability to do the work we need to do for genetic testing. And secondly, I guess I'll just leave it with that. The rest is more.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Holmer,
I think the committee should know that when you look at the handout that Ms. Brace put together, this past year the Department of Health went through a rulemaking process to try and get around the legislative logjam and actually ran into a bigger brick wall, and the ALJ ruled that they should be giving a Tennyson on this stuff. So current law would require that. What the Peason bill is doing is to try and resolve some of those issues as well, but I think the committee should know that.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify the chronology here, we passed a law related to newborn screening, and this goes to the inadvertent comment. I don't think I said it was inadvertent from the genetic testing, and I didn't mean to imply that, so if I did, I'm sorry. But we had the newborn screening bill, which set up a consent procedure for newborn screening, and that was legislatively enacted. In 2006, a generalized rule was passed with regard to genetic testing, and that created the conflict, and the ALJ ruled that the more general law covered instead of the newborn screening rule. So, in fact, the legislature has acted with specificity with regard to newborn screening and set up this system that we're trying to put and make sure is in place. But the main point on this amendment is it does undermine the ability of the department and providers to provide the kind of accurate testing that we really need to help kids and families avoid these problems.
Okay. First, we'll take the roll.
Trustee Senator Mallory.
No.
Trustee Senator Pickham. I'll come back to you. Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Representative DeLaForest.
Yes.
Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kalin.
No.
Representative Coles. Representative Kranz. Representative Lesch.
No.
Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Tamer.
No.
Representative Saylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith. Representative Westrum.
Bigham.
Representative Bigham.
No.
Sales. Representative Emmer, do you have another amendment?
I do. I think in light of that vote, I'm just going to jump to the A1. And I don't think I'll do the A5 today. We'll save that for another time. But again, this one's self-explanatory. And I just want to add, because Representative Thiessen, while I respect your view, every time you say this would preclude us from doing what needs to be done, folks, that's not true. What it is, we're talking about giving people the right to make an informed consent. We're requiring whoever is doing these tests to tell them up front and let them make an informed decision. That's what informed consent is. It's not on the backside. And there was a saying we used to have on the playground when one of the kids would all of a sudden start dividing up the teams, and I think it was something that went along the lines of, who died and made you God? This same thing we're doing here. We shouldn't be the ones that are just deciding for parents what's best for them. This amendment would say exactly what it says. You got to provide a Tennyson warning, and more importantly, whether Representative Thiessen agrees that this is going to happen someday or not, it's not a scare tactic, I will say that. I think those are inappropriate words here. This is an honest disagreement. It's interesting that you've got blood tests dating back to 1986 that haven't been destroyed. Sounds like this 24-month rule is working out really well. It says the commissioner may not perform genetic testing or genetic research or use DNA or genetic information with prior informed written consent. Certainly that's something we can all agree on, that before somebody starts to take this DNA material, which can be related to a name of a person, that they should at least be given the opportunity to decide whether that whether they want that to happen. And I ask for a roll call on this.
Representative,
well, I would also oppose this, and the 24 months is that it can actually be destroyed at people's request after 24 months, and in fact that has been used by families. Whether you believe that or not, Representative Emmer, it has in fact, and I don't need a response. But the point here,
take shot is,
one. We do this in healthcare all the time. The point here is that the opt-out, and there's research, scientific research that backs out, is that an opt-in is a much less effective method of for the research that, and it's not research in terms of tracking people's genetics, but it's making sure that these tests work correctly, that we start avoiding false positives. And if you have an opt-in versus an opt-out, the validity and reliability of those tests is severely undermined. And that's why I'm opposing this. I understand where Representative Emmer is coming from, and I don't want it to appear that I don't think people need this information, because that's what we're trying to do here. We're providing people with information, and we're trying to bulk that information up in this. And so it's not about whether they have information or not. But the opt-in is a less effective way scientifically to make sure that we get the types of evidence that we need to have a valid testing of these tests.
Ms. Brace, really, like 20 seconds?
I will be. Really. I do think it's important for the community to understand that the Centers for Disease Control has already put out the idea of taking all the data samples, all the blood samples from all the children in all the country to create one big database for research purposes. I do not think that it is a small thing that we would take and do research on all of our people and every one of those children become an adult in 18 years. We're building a data bank, a database, a genetic database of every citizen in this country, and we're starting state by state.
Okay. Then all in.
No.
Roll call. Oh, I'm sorry. Clerk will take the roll.
Representative Mueller.
No.
Representative Bigham.
No.
Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Representative De La Forest.
Yes.
Representative Emmer. Representative Hillstrom. Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kalin.
No.
Representative Coles. Representative Kranz. Representative Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Olin.
Pass.
Representative Paymar.
No.
Representative Taylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith. Representative Westrom.
Olin votes aye.
It fails on a tie. Back to the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cornish.
Just a procedural matter. I'm wondering, to save some time, since this is such a highly intrusive bill, an invasion of privacy, I wonder if you'd be interested in putting Photocop on it. We could deal with all the constitutional violations at one time.
We'll deal with that later.
Okay. All in favor? Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Paymer.
Are you moving the bill?
Yes, please.
I just would like to make the point in your screening report, you don't delineate the opting out of research as part of the study. You've covered the other components, but not reporting on the opting out. You say under clause number 4, you have opt out of collection of data specimens, but you don't include the research. I would think that you could probably fill that in.
Okay. All Representative Paymar renews his motion to pass as amended, and we refer to Health and Human Services Committee. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, members.
Representative Peterson, thank you for bringing such a non-controversial quick bill. Simple. No emotion.
Thank you.
The guy that's trying to decide
the
Constitution, you're up.
What?
Well, I thought that was
Oh, that's right. He's doing that too. It's all everybody. All these non-controversial stuff, all not emotional ones.
I think we should have just distributed copies of the Constitution again today. Make sure everybody's had it for it.
No. Representative West, we are going to set some time limits around 8 for each side. I think should be about enough, isn't that? I mean, most people kind of understand where it seems like a big war just ready to happen. They understand where they are. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. I know how strictly you keep your word on time limits, so I'm in big trouble. I'll do my best to turn it down. So I'd move House File 12.
It's a pleasure. You suggested at the appointed hour, I just have Representative Cornish pick off who's talking.
Yes.
So moved. Go ahead.
I move House File 1218, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh moves House File 1218.
Thank you.
Representative Owens?
Just a procedural question. Is this going directly to the floor or to any committee?
Well, Representative Owen, I'm pretty sure it has to go to. I certainly, from what I've heard, this has huge fiscal impact. So I think it's not going to the floor.
That's what I wanted. I want clarification on that.
Mr. Chair, I don't know who told you that.
In fact, I think Representative Tamar will get a sticker shock when the when the fiscal note comes back, if they can ever figure out the cost.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm certain that while I would dispute the fact that there should be a fiscal impact to this, I'm sure it will be brought up by opposition to this bill, and we would anticipate having a full vetting of that topic in Finance Committee, Representative Paymar's committee, so I would appreciate your help in getting this bill to that committee where we can have that discussion. Mr. Chair, may I have you heard on House File 1218 now?
I'm sorry, Mr.
Can I talk about the bill?
Yes, Representative.
I'm going to shut off my phone so they don't yell at me for that, too. Mr. Chair, you know, when this came up, I realized, and I found out quickly, I know why you scheduled the bill for this week, because I found out this week was the Public Defender's Day on the Hill. And I soon discovered that this was the cause celeb for the public defenders this year, and much to my surprise. And when they came to me, a lot of them called me after this, and they said, "Hey, I heard you're on this committee, Lash. Can you kill this bill?" And I said they should go look at the chief author, and you know, they did. And then they said, well, can we, you know, maybe reach some compromise? And then I looked, I said, yeah, let me look at the full text of the bill and see. And realized it's just one sentence. So I would have proposed to add at the end of it, but we still love all the public defenders. Although I don't know if that would go anywhere. Nonetheless, Mr. Chair, members, this bill, even though, as I stated, has been taken up as being suggested that it's unconstitutional and it's unfair, really what this bill aims to do is to ensure that there is fairness in the courtroom. Members, you've been told this week by a lot of people that the criminal courts exist to protect the rights of criminal defendants. That's not true. The criminal courts exist to ensure that fairness and truth comes out in disputes about when someone is accused. And we have rules that we put forth to ensure that there is an accurate resolution of those disputes. Now, as we all know, the Constitution is slanted in favor of the defendant in many cases. For example, as a prosecutor, it's my job to prove my case, and the judge tells the jury multiple times the defendant need prove nothing. Furthermore, I need to prove my case beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a high standard. Third, when you go to pick a finder of fact, the defense gets more than twice the strikes that a prosecutor does in deciding who this fact finder is going to be on the jury. Multiple ways that it's slanted. Furthermore, the Minnesota Constitution guarantees certain rights that the federal Constitution doesn't. But what we're talking about here is just trying to ensure that that fact finder remains fair. And I'm going to tell you why this happens. And I'll tell you a story. When I went in last year for one jury trial, and this has only happened, I'll be honest, in the 30 cases I've tried to a jury, this has only happened two or three times. But what we do is we go into chambers, and you stick your finger in the wind. You find out where things are. Where is the judge going to be on certain evidentiary rulings? And what, you know, where are they inclined towards sentencing? And then the defense attorney goes back and talks to their client and says, this is what you're looking at. Do you want to plead? Or do you want to go to trial? Well, if they're given an indication, as they are many times, where the judge is on the case, sometimes, and not all the time, but sometimes the defense attorney is going to say, oh, bench trial, we know where this one's going. And then, of course, the prosecutor knows where it's going too. Members, I would suggest that is patently unfair to victims of crime and to the public who it's my charge to represent in the courtroom. So this is to ensure that when, in fact, the finder of fact is to be determined as chosen by all parties. Now, the United States Supreme Court has made clear in decisions that the defendant's only constitutional right, and this is Chief Justice Earl Warren speaking, The only constitutional right considering the method of trial is to an impartial trial by jury, and there is no constitutional impediment to the requirement of government consent, since the result of the government's refusal to consent is simply that the defendant is subject to an impartial trial by jury, the very thing the Constitution guarantees. Furthermore, it's been suggested that in Minnesota, no, it's different. In Minnesota, we guarantee more rights, and defense attorneys are very proud that their clients get more rights in Minnesota than they do nationally. Nonetheless, the Minnesota Constitution says that a jury trial may be waived by the parties, plural. That's what this legislation seeks to enact, and I would ask your support, but members and Mr. Chair, we have testifiers here.
Mr. Backstrom, it's been pretty well set forth by Representative Lesch.
So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Try to do it quickly.
Members, Representative Lesch, I'm James Bastian, Dakota County Attorney, President of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. This is, as Representative Lesch indicated, a simple and straightforward bill. It is the County Attorneys Association's highest legislative priority. And there's a simple reason for that. This is a proposal that will strengthen one of the bedrock principles underlying our entire system of criminal justice. That's the issue of fairness and the right to have issues in a criminal trial ultimately decided by the citizens of our state. Fairness in a criminal trial is a two-way street. It needs to be applied with equal vigor to both sides of the case. The right to trial by jury is one of the most fundamental constitutional protections underlying the criminal justice system in America. It is a basic safeguard, the personal liberty for the accused, and it is a right that should be applied equally to our citizens as well. There are 28 other states in America and the federal criminal justice process that recognize that these constitutional protections and the due process rights that inure to our citizens should apply equally to both sides in the criminal case. The clear majority in America has concluded that the prosecutor who represents the public has a legitimate interest in the manner of how a trial proceeds and the right to request a jury trial in all instances. We believe this same right should be applied here in Minnesota as well. I've heard, as Representative Lesch has heard and others, the comments from our state's defense attorneys that you're likely to hear again today, that this is an attack upon our judiciary, that certain cases are of such high visibility that a fair trial cannot occur before a jury, that some cases are so highly technical that only a trial before a judge can result in a fair and a just proceeding. In response, let me just offer a few comments. First of all, this is not a question of being disrespectful or distrustful of the bench. My colleagues and I have the highest respect for the members of our judiciary. This is about assuring public confidence in our system of criminal justice. It's about assuring equal fairness and due process to both sides in a criminal case. As to the high profile or highly emotional cases that come before the court, that is why we have rules in place to allow the change of venue. And that is why we have strikes in place to ensure that the jurors selected in the case are in fact fair and will review the facts and the evidence in such a manner. Defense attorneys accuse us of being disrespectful and untrustful of the bench for wanting this rule change, saying that jurors can't make decisions fairly in these highly emotional or technical cases. Quite frankly, I view that as an insult to the intelligence of the jurors, the citizens in our communities. I have confidence and faith in the ability of jurors to sort through difficult issues and to be fair and just when they're doing so. They do it all the time. Defense attorneys want to claim that prosecutors will use this particular change as a tactical tool to gain advantage in a criminal trial. I would submit to you that the same argument can be made of the current rule, that defendants waive juries to gain a tactical advantage, as Representative Flesch has indicated, after some predisposition may be made apparent. The change really isn't about tactics, however. It's about allowing the state to have the option of having a case tried before the tribunal of the Constitution, that the Constitution regards as the most likely to produce a fair result. And as Representative Lesch indicated, those are the words of the United States Supreme Court, the Earl Warren Supreme Court. you know, a court that perhaps has gone home more than any other in this nation is protecting the civil rights of American citizens. I submit to you that this is a change that will be used sparingly by prosecutors in cases that are of such significance that trusting the final judgment to one human being rather than 12 may not assure the appearance of fairness and public confidence in our system of justice. That's the bottom line. We want to make sure that due process and fairness apply to both. I'd like to ask Paul Young from the Anoka County Attorney's Office to talk briefly about constitutional issues and offer a specific case example.
Mr. Young, we'll give you 2 minutes. You're over the time already.
2 minutes. Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee. I think the constitutional issue is clear. This is not trying to gain something that is not there. This is found in the Minnesota Constitution. The language cited by the chief author says the party. That's what it says. The Minnesota cases that have interpreted jury waiver have not made any distinction between the application of that language parties to civil or criminal cases. In fact, just the opposite has occurred. There are published and unpublished cases that talk about the application of parties to jury waiver. We should have a voice at the table on that very important issue as to who is going to hear the case. We don't even have a voice in waiver. It simply happens where the defendant makes the request and it's over. As a case example to highlight this, I know there's been some discussion that this is recent. This is a knee-jerk reaction to a particular case going through the system now. This has been an issue for quite some time in Anoka County. We had a case a number of years ago, two co-defendants charged with a $99,000 theft. On two different occasions working with a judge, they tried to get that case either continued for dismissal, stay of adjudication. That happened. The state appealed. The state prevailed. It came back on the third try when the case came up for trial. What did the defense do? You all know the answer. They waived the jury. Guess what happened? You know the answer. This is despite two admissions to a $99,000 theft. This is what occurred. We should have an opportunity to at least be heard on the issue. We are excluded now. This bill makes sense. It levels the playing field.
Representative Lynch.
Thank you. And I know we're over time, but I would just say one thing. Normally they tell you in law school that you lead with your strongest argument. And I think I totally forgot to mention, people may not know, but this exists in 30 states and the federal system. They all think that it perfectly guards the constitutional rights of the defendant. So I just wanted to bring that up before we conclude.
Representative Lush, I have a question. Why do you say it's in 30 states and your witness says 28?
I don't know, 28, 30, whatever, you know. Somewhere up there.
The majority of yesterday's Representative Lush, it was 31, you said. Representative Cornish, do you have a question of these witnesses?
Yeah, I've got a question of the two lawyers there, the prosecutors.
They're all prosecutors.
Yeah, only well, the witness. First, I should apologize. When the prosecutors came to my office, I gave you the opinion that or the idea that I'd be on your side. But since I've had time to think about it, I disagree with you on the constitutional portion of this. I think just as much as you've got a right to a jury trial, you've got a right not to have a jury trial. Just because you have a right to a jury trial, it's the flip side. Everything in the Constitution points to the rights of the defendant time and time again, all the way up in all of our legal documents. I mean, the paramount is the rights of the defendant and his or her right to choose, I believe. And so if he or she doesn't want a jury trial, it goes the other way. And just as there might have been a miscarriage of justice as a judge having the trial, look what happened in the O.J. trial. A known murderer got turned loose by the jury. So it can go wrong both ways. Throw all of that out, it comes down to the basic right of the defendant. And if the defendant wants to have a judge instead of a jury, I can't see us stepping in and saying, no, that's not your right, because we think you're going to get off. I think, why would we change something that's been in place already and it seems to be working? I mean, it just doesn't seem fair. As much as I am going to lock him up and throw away the key guy, I also respect the rights of the defendant.
Well, I think we've provided at least a couple of examples of why it is a problem. Here, my case example is these people had admitted on two other occasions to this theft, but that same judge still, after clearly tipping his or her hand, says what's going to occur, and it's found not guilty. And I do just want to clarify, the U.S. Supreme Court has not said, because you have a right to a jury trial, you also have a right to waive it. That's not the language, and in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has said it does not mean that. What happens when you don't get a court trial is you get what the Constitution guarantees you, which is a jury trial.
Mr. Young, we've gone through that, and I think yes. Representative Cornish's was more of a statement of his views, and he has the right, and we all have our rights, and Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, real quickly, for Representative Lesch, I was absolutely opposed to this, and then as I've listened to it, do I understand correctly that the issue is not taking away the defendant's right to a jury? It's more an issue of not allowing the defendant to manipulate the system simply because a judge may be favorable to an issue as opposed to not favorable. I mean, is it the manipulation of the system? Because I don't agree Mr. Backstrom, I'm a huge, I'm a fan. I like the work that you do. If there's such a thing of county attorney
available for autographs.
Yeah, there's county attorney. I have your card. I'm collecting
them. Remember, do you practice in Dakota County quite a bit?
Well, I won't tell you where my lips are. What I'm getting at is that as I was listening to you, I disagree. It should not be an equal playing field, and I think that's what Representative Cornish is getting at. The right should favor the defendant when the government is coming down on them, is my view. But in this case, if they're manipulating the system by saying all of a sudden I want to waive a jury because I've got some favorable ruling that really you should be letting a jury decide, is that what we're talking about, Representative?
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair, that's
very clear because that's another
quick answer, yes, and slightly longer than yes is, and remember that you're right because 30 or 28, whatever, jurisdictions plus the federal system think this way, and it's the only way that it changes if you want Minnesota for them to have additional rights to a court trial at the expense potentially of justice or the rights of the victims as well. So, yes.
And Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
A real question?
This is a real question. I've been thinking a lot about this, actually, and I even called a couple people I know, friends in this area, one of who's a law professor. That doesn't mean he's better or has a better judgment, but he's just common law. So I... What's that? Yeah. Anyway, because I'm truly conflicted on this. I really am. And let me ask you a couple questions. First of all, what would be the problem if what we're trying to get at is manipulation of the system, where you're into the pretrial phase and you've gotten a number of favorable rulings for the defendant, and if the defendant is sort of gaming the system as you see it, what would be the problem? And I don't practice criminal law, so you're going to have to educate me here. But what would be the problem with making a defendant, for example, make that choice early on in the process, maybe right after the judge has been assigned? Now, I understand there could still be some gaming in the system if Judge X is known as a softy and, you know, by reputation. But at least in that circumstance, early enough in the process where there haven't been evidentiary rulings, where they could waive it, what would that present a problem of any kind? Wouldn't that be a way to get at what you're saying, but not tip the scales too far against the accused?
Representative Lesch.
Well, I would say, first of all, I mean, that's been brought up to me. Did you bring that up to me before? Somebody brought that up to me before. And I talked to him, I said, you know, most of these decisions that the defendant makes, we don't even make. For example, the right to whether they want to testify, we don't make them waive that or not until halfway into the case, until the state's case is over. Because the idea is, for example, if in order to avoid this type of fact finder shopping, you said you have to make a choice at the time, say, the judge is assigned, which is when the time period starts tolling for when you're going to remove that judge because you think they're prejudicial. I cannot imagine at arraignment, for example, when a judge is assigned, you say, okay, and by the way, if this goes to trial, are you going to do bench trial or jury trial? They're going to have no idea whatsoever. They're just not going to know. And so while that would alleviate the problem, I don't know that it would be that just to ask a defendant that at that point. And I think that defense attorneys would testify to the same. They're just not going to know.
I'm sorry. Again, I know we're pressed for time, but I think a lot of us are trying to do the right thing here. So what about this argument, too? Not mine, but one of my outside gurus suggested, which is, who is neutral on this, by the way, so he wasn't pushing me in one way or another. You know, just as you talk about judge shopping, isn't it true that prosecutors can also do jury shopping? What if there's some notorious case, I'm sure this happens a lot, the Dakota County strangler, let's say, who strangles widows and orphans in the dead of night, and now they've got someone, the Dakota County strangler, everyone hates this person, who in the public mind maybe is presumed to be the right guy, and maybe for also strategic reasons, when there's a legitimate reason for a defendant to waive the right to a jury trial, let's just pretend for a second, in this hypothetical that's absolutely legitimate, with a wink and a nod, maybe the prosecutor said, no, heck no, we want a jury. This guy's hated. And as you know, jury selection is an imperfect tool. You ask people about their biases. A lot of people don't tell the truth, or they shade the truth, or they don't emphasize the truth, and it's an imperfect tool. If you've got an absolutely, and let's say the motion to move the venue of the trial has been denied in my hypothetical, isn't there jury shopping that goes on as well in terms of, man, we really want a jury in this case. This guy's hated.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, two things. First of all, I mean, as has been stated, the people that have opinions on this already should be stricken for cause prior to the time any peremptory strikes are taken. And that should weed everyone out. And I think judges and both sides do a pretty good job at that. Now, in the event if people lie in jury selection and some sneak through who know about it and have an opinion, you know, defense still gets over twice the strikes that the state does, which is how it's slanted toward the defendant, thereby further ensuring the impartiality of a jury of one's peers. So I think that that's alleviated by the natural slant toward the defendant already. And as you brought up, as Mr. Basher pointed out to me, the change of venue should take care of that as well.
One other quick, just factual question. I don't know the answer to this. Would this be appealable then, either on any basis? Would the lack of consent given somehow be an appealable issue? I don't know the answer.
My answer, when you asked me that yesterday, my answer was, obviously, if you could show in a similar, in way of a Batson challenge, if you showed that there was some problem with it because of an individual's race, I would gather that that would be the case, but I'm just actually just pulled that out of the air. I don't know.
Okay, can we finally go to the other side? Mr. Greg Egan, I don't see Fred Friedman, but I don't think he's here, is he? And John Stewart. Mr. Stewart, are you the coordinator of this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. We've got Ms. Christine Kohler here in place of Mr. Friedman. You have to go back to Duluth. Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. And with me here today are four of the state's 10 district chief public defenders. Last night at 6, 9 out of the 10 were here, and I'm sorry that they can't all be here with us today. As has been suggested, we are here because we are seriously concerned about this bill and its implications. You've heard that 28 or maybe 30 or maybe 31 states do what the county attorneys want you to legislate for Minnesota to do. And so it's a good question to put to us, why not Minnesota? Three reasons, which I'll summarize, and I want to then say a little more about two of them. Minnesota has its own state constitution, and each other state does also, and each state constitution is different. Secondly, each state has its own set of rules of court procedure for handling criminal trials. Minnesota has a criminal rules of procedure committee, and each other state has its own means to set those rules. Thirdly, Minnesota is fortunate to have an excellent, excellent set of judges. Many of the other states that would be included in that 28 or 30 or 31 wouldn't be able to say that. One inescapable implication of this bill is that you can't trust a district court judge to try a case. I'm going to go to the Constitution for a minute because that seems to be an issue that's important to members of the committee. And I would just say that the black and white handout that you've got there, you've got my couple of talking points here in Technicolor, and you've got a black and white handout I want to refer to. In Article 6 of the Constitution, there's a discussion of criminal prosecution. And it says that it's the accused person who has the right to a jury trial. The section that was referred to by Representative Lesch is Section 4, which, if you look at it, it is all about civil cases. It refers to the amount in controversy, it refers to a civil action, it refers to a partial jury, it refers to a civil action again. That's the civil case trial by jury right. The right in Article 6 for criminal cases is that it's the individual right of the accused. As has been pointed out, there are certain individual rights that are in the Bill of Rights for the purpose of protecting the individual from the government. Now, the government is coming in here and saying, well, we want to have those rights. Well, you know, these rights were created to protect the individual from the government. And the individual can exercise them or waive them. The individual has the right to have a lawyer, but they don't have to. They have a right to testify in court, but they don't have to. And they have a right to have a trial by jury, but they don't have to. It's an individual right for the person. It's not a right for the government. May I also respectfully suggest to this committee, Mr. Chair, that this is a topic which is covered by the rules of criminal procedure, which are set by our courts. About 30 years ago, the legislature decided that the courts ought to run their own operations. And at that time, you repealed 46 statutes that governed criminal procedure in order to send the whole group of them over to the Supreme Court to be worked out. That's the Rules of Criminal Procedure Committee. I'm mentioning this because I talked to the chair of the Rules of Criminal Procedure Committee yesterday morning, Justice Paul Anderson, and he says that this issue is on the agenda for the Rules of Procedure Committee for Saturday, March 15th. That's going to be their meeting topic next week. And I would respectfully say this is something that the courts ought to work on in the context of their process and their other rules. Finally, I'd say, Mr. Chair and members, this is an issue that's been looked at several times over 150 years. In the formation of the Constitution in 1857, 1858, it was decided it's a right of the individual. When you first passed a statute on it in 1935, it was decided it's the right of the individual. 1971, amended statute, it's the right of the individual. It's still the right of the individual. It should not be a right that would be given to the government. And I hope you preserve that historical, constitutional Minnesota tradition today. Other states may do things differently, but we have our own system here which has served us well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kohler, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christine Kohler, and I'm the Chief Public Defender in the 9th District, 17 counties of Northwest Minnesota. I have three brief points. With regard to the strikes we have against jurors, the prosecution has three strikes, the defense has five. With regard to Representative Simon's questions about making this a decision early on in the process, in many of the rural counties throughout the state, a judge is assigned when the case is filed. And so we would be required then to make that decision early on in the process when we wouldn't have enough information. With regard to Mr. Young's statements that the prosecution has no voice in the waiver process, they do. That waiver has to be approved by the court, and the prosecution has the right to weigh in to that decision as to whether or not the waiver will be granted, and that is subject to appellate review. There's an abuse of discretion standard. Finally, with regard to Mr. Baxton's comments about judges tipping their hand and thereby indicating a bias against the prosecution and defense counsel waiving juries in order to take advantage of that bias, there is a rule that allows the prosecution to remove a judge for cause if they believe that that judge is going to be a biased decision maker. Thank you.
Mr. Egan.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the benefit of testifying at the end of the contentious debate, so I'll appeal to a common interest and be brief. I'm a citizen of St. Paul. I'm also a recent law school graduate, contemplating a career in criminal law. There's been a lot of discussion about what effect this has on the rights of a criminal defendant. And as an aspiring attorney in my position, I would just emphasize that anything that undercuts the constitutionally enshrined right of the accused makes the choice I've just made to pursue a career in criminal law a more difficult one to make. It also undercuts the rights afforded to the individuals in our Constitution. I would suffice to say that I disagree with Representative Lesch's interpretation of the Constitution. He's a recent student of constitutional law. That's something that also has a particular impact on me. From that perspective, earlier this week I sent an email to members of this committee. Suffice to say that I also disagree with Representative Lesch's interpretation, at least a matter of practice. It's the slant towards criminal defendants in our system. And I would end with that.
Okay. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question is basically a follow-up on Representative Simons. Doesn't necessarily mean from 32 years' experience as a county attorney I agree with it, but it's just the thought on Representative Simons having practiced criminal law and knowing the area better, and I just want to get a reaction, and I probably need one from both groups that I didn't get a chance to ask earlier. The reaction, the question exactly is, and I agree at arraignment, it's probably too early, but what if you were to put wording in saying prior to a hearing at any motions, and I'm throwing that out as a suggestion.
Now, Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, I think that that's something that the Criminal Rules of Procedure Committee might be able to work out. The scheduling of criminal cases is different in most of the counties. You know, there's places that combine the Rule 5 and the Rule 8 hearing. There's places that separate them. There's places where the omnibus hearing is split into two halves. There are a lot of variations in how those motion calendars and trial assignment calendars are set up around the state. And that's another reason why I think that the judges and lawyers and prosecutors in the Criminal Rules Committee are the ones to sit and work this out. I think it's going to be hard to work it out here this morning.
Representative Olin.
And I'm not saying, for purposes of moving forward, I'm just saying that the and I'm throwing this out, realizing my county attorneys probably do not agree with my philosophy on life on this question in the first place, but I'm looking for a reality situation because I can think of some examples that sometimes do bother me. I'm not going to name them at this time, but I'm just throwing that out, and I know what you're saying, but I'm trying to get past the Rule 5 of arraignment hearing into some other date that has to be set. And it's probably requiring a date that has to be set, and the omnibus is supposed to be held so fast, and that I know the procedures in county districts vary, but I'm just getting before an omnibus hearing of some type, of anything.
Representative Bigham, very quickly.
Real briefly, Chair. What I would ask is, brought this up, and I'm just curious, by having a defendant waive the right to a jury, are you not having that, or to a judge? What's the word am I thinking of it?
Waive the right to a jury.
Thank you. That was right the first time. I have to stop doubting myself. Somehow, is that jury now not impartial? I mean, is just a question to you. I mean, is that what you feel, or is that what your concern is, that somehow by waiving it, the jury will not be impartial anymore? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bigham, I've seen cases in which there is an important legal issue in the case, but there's also been a lot of pretrial publicity. There's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of strong feelings in the community. And in some cases like that, I think the person who is on trial, who may be looking at many, many years in prison, I think that person ought to be the one to make the choice whether to have the jury or not. With the amount of stuff you see about crime on TV and in the papers and so on, sometimes that person thinks, you know, I want to just have my trial before a judge. And I think that they ought to continue to have the right as an individual the way they have had it here in Minnesota the last 150 years.
Okay, Representative Olin moves his, renews his motion to pass and re-refer it to the Finance Committee with a recommendation to go to the Public Safety Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. Representative Thiessen.
Sorry, I couldn't figure out how I was going to say it. I just have tremendous respect for what you do, and I've got to say it. But, you know, I can tell you it's been exciting, very cool. Good to see you guys.
Everything's
Representative Thiessen, I think we heard this last year. I think maybe about 5 minutes on each side is probably enough.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any amendments on this?
There isn't one amendment. I think Representative Olin has an amendment.
Okay. Go ahead, somebody has to move it.
I'll move it.
Representative Seymour moves House File 3863. Representative Thiessen, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is the Stop on Red legislation, it's aimed really, what it's about is increasing traffic safety, and we know that it works to do that. We had a 31% reduction in crashes, a 42% reduction in T-bone crashes when this was in place for a few months in Minneapolis. So basically, we know it saves lives, it avoids injuries, it avoids property damages, it saves on insurance rates. And just a couple other points that are important to keep in mind. These are not general surveillance cameras like the cameras we have in the Capitol that's watching us every minute of the day. Better watch out. These only are triggered when a red light is actually run. And that's, I think, a very significant point here. And the data must be destroyed when it's either used or if it's not going to be used. So this is really really just a tool that's used to avoid what are really significant crashes. And I don't know if we can get the page to, is there a way to click this up on the screen there? While my testifier testifies, just to show you what kind of crashes this would avoid. That's what we're trying to do here. It's been effective. The difference from last year's bill is that we are putting a 2-year sunset on it, just to make sure, because I know there's a lot of discomfort about this bill, to make sure that it works and that some of the problems that people are concerned about don't in fact occur. It's a petty misdemeanor. It doesn't show up for insurance purposes. All the things were in the bill last year to give people comfort about what we're attempting to do here are there. I would note that there's a positive fiscal note to the state of about $2 million, which may interest people as we move forward here. So, with that, I'd like the testifier to speak with your indulgence.
What's his name?
Can you introduce yourself?
Hi. My name is John Cummings. I'm the founder of Minnesotans for Safe Driving. We're a victim advocate organization. We deal with the results of people who run red lights and all other forms of tragedies. And we deal with what happens afterwards. We help the families get through this. Just two cases I'd like to talk about. Last year out in Apple Valley, Rebecca Jakob, she's 21 years old. The 3.5 grade point average at the university. She's sitting at a red light on 146th Street and Cedar Avenue. Light turns green, she proceeds through the intersection, boom, here comes a pickup truck right through the red light, hits her, kills her. She's four blocks from home. Saturday morning, she's ready to go, scheduled to go to Italy for a six-month semester of college. She had her bags all packed, you know. We had to go in there and help the family get through all of this. They're forever wondering where their daughter would be now. What would she be doing? What would her life be like, you know? And then Jesse Heller, 16 years old, is from Coon Rapids. Him and a 17-year-old cousin are going to the movies up in New Brighton. It's going to the movies. There's a guy named Lawrence Maxey, who was a repeat offender, and there's a warrant out for his arrest, and the cops light him up, and he flees. Runs a red light, hits that pickup truck. He killed 16-year-old Jesse Heller. His 17-year-old cousin's got irreversible brain damage. These are the things that happen. This is the reality of this. And I think communities have the... they should have the ability to protect their citizens, and this is one of the things that'll do it. This changes behavior, because people do these things because they never think they're going to get caught. One of the things that we do in our organization, I work with both victims and offenders. And then nobody ever thinks that this will happen to them. And that's exactly who it happens to, and it happens to all the time. You know, and it's just, it's insanity the way we drive out there. I talk to driver's ed students all the time. In fact, I'm going to do it in Burnsville tomorrow, and there'll be 400 driver's ed students there, and they have to bring their parents. And we talk about all these things, about people speeding up and going through a yellow light. And you can see the kids turn and look at their parents. That's where they're learning this stuff.
Representative Keith, and your 5 minutes is up now.
But this is what it's like. And
is there any opposition to this?
Yeah. I'm just going to explain that Bill Gillespie was in the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, had to leave. He was going to be in opposition speaking for the cops in the state.
Yes, Representative Cornish, that's true. He told me yesterday they were very opposed to it, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association.
I don't know.
He started through it, and I couldn't wait for the whole thing.
For sure, if I could give you 5 minutes, I could tell you.
It'd
take a lot less than that.
Representative Cornish, let me make sure. There's nobody that's testifying against this. Okay. Representative Cornish, you can explain
okay. The
reason.
I'll do it real quick. I'm not going to talk a long time. I don't have enough votes on my side probably to stop this today, so I'm going to have to rely on my good friends on the other side. The reason the cops were going to testify against this is because time and time again through this committee over the years we've expressed community policing. This is about the farthest thing you can get from community police work that there is. It's electronic police work. And you miss the officer walking up to the door and hearing the wife that had a fight with her husband in a hurry to get to work and feeling bad, and you don't get a chance to hear her excuse. You miss the person that this plane had a bad day. The person's got a couple of people that's late to a funeral or a wedding. Extenuating circumstances, the cop usually gets to walk up to the door and at least hear the defendant sign. All you're going to get is a ticket in the mail. And the reason that there's some support here is that they've baited the thing just like they did administrative penalties. You'll see money going to EMS, so we've got EMS people here to support it. You'll see money going to chiefs and sheriffs. And it's just a bad bill. It takes away community policing. It goes in the opposite direction. They've got signs up to warn people that the deal is there. The death you're talking about probably wouldn't have been prevented. They'd maybe help find the person that got in the accident, but it's literally not going to prevent the accident. It's going to see the cars afterwards, unless it's going to educate the people that go through the sign time and time again. But what about the people that come through the first time? So I don't see this as going to be a death reducer. And you can say that about any of our traffic laws or gizmos you put out there, or cameras. Is it really worth what we lose to make up for that? So that's basically the opposition. And then, if I could, at some time we'd get to amendments. I just wanted to show you where there's like 10 or 12 mistakes in here that should be amended if it does move on.
Representative Cornish, one thing he pointed out to me very strongly was the lack of having an officer there and discretion, in that an officer present can judge whether the person really was trying to maybe slow down, maybe thought to live, whatever. Just thought that there was a lot of need for actually seeing the car as it was coming, which this would cut off. This doesn't show the car until it's in the intersection, and so that was one of the things Mr. Gillespie pointed out. But
also there's a petty misdemeanor, and that way that they won't even have a right to a jury trial under a petty misdemeanor. So this person would get a ticket in the mail and not even have a right to a jury trial under this system. So it's I don't know how you're going to work that. But
Mr. Chair, just briefly on that, I actually think this does help with community policing. I would disagree, because it frees up officers to actually do community policing. And that is one of the things that we saw in Minneapolis. And, in fact, we have evidence in the 8 months it was in place that accidents were reduced by 31%. I just do want to show this to the committee. If I
is that an accident?
This is an I mean, that's the kind of accident that we are avoiding by putting in this type of... We had a 42% reduction in that type of accident at these intersections.
Mr. Chair?
Tamer, do you have a question on this particular thing?
Okay. Well, sort of, but I also have a question on the bill.
Well, I was going to go to Representative Olin.
Had
his hand up, and he has an amendment, so... Representative Olin, did you want to move your...
Thank you, Mr.
A1?
Chairman. I'll move my A1 amendment, which basically does give 2.3% to the Emergency Medical Services Fund and sets out how it's to be used. Increasing traffic safety obviously enters into the world of emergency services, and so it is an attempt to get some funding over to the EMS people that is badly needed also. So I can speak in more detail if I have to, but
I represent Holberg.
Thank you. To the amendment, why only in rural Minnesota?
Representative Olin.
I think the reason I emphasize rural Minnesota in that one is rural Minnesota is really struggling with the emergency medical services a lot worse than elsewhere.
Well, and Mr. Chair, that maybe the amendment should have based on need, but, you know, it's just... To have all of the money, I'm sure if Minneapolis will jump right back on board on this and be one of the major revenue raisers.
Mr. Chair, to clarify, this is actually money for everywhere.
And, Mr. Chair, why does it say rural, to recruit and retain rural ambulance personnel?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I'm also a former paramedic. The intent of this, and I apologize to Representative Olin for not clarifying this sooner, there are 8 regions in the state. The metro has one of its own, and each board determines where the dollars are spent that would come out of this fund. The reason that we put the specific wording in is in rural Minnesota, our primary focus is recruitment and retention. We're 62% volunteer in the state, and we're not able to get volunteers, right? Not even able to get paid people. But we're just trying to indicate or emphasize rural EMS, and but it's all inclusive. It includes the metro area region, too.
Doesn't say that.
Well, the EMS fund on line 1.6, it's described in the statute that under 144E.50, it addresses the regional EMS programs. There are 8 of them, and the metro region is not excluded.
Mr. Chair, it said it must be used to create and fund ongoing programs to recruit and retain rural ambulance personnel.
Representative Olin, do you want to...
Mr. Chairman, the only comment I'd make is that there are 8 regional, and it does include all the regionals.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg, I agree with you.
I really need to get OJ back here because he needs to clarify whether Metro is rural.
Representative Holberg, there's a farm in Minneapolis.
And Representative Holberg, it sounds like we're in the Transportation Committee and discussing Chicago County, where Metro is rural and rural is Metro.
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming this bill has to go there as well. So,
Mr. Chairman, perhaps if I might respectfully suggest, just how about deleting the word rural?
Mr. Chairman, that's what I was going to suggest, but I hadn't talked to Mr. Doyle beforehand, but if you remove the word rural from line 1.7 and 1.8, then that objection maybe isn't.
Representative Holbert, that's satisfied.
Mr. Chair, I think it makes it better. I don't like the bill.
Yes, you. I realize you probably won't vote for the bill anyway, but at least it eliminates that headache.
Yeah, I know. Let's see. Holberg moves the amendments to delete the words rural. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Rowland, your motion's up. Is there any discussion of it?
I don't believe there's any more need for discussion.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Mr. Gillespie, do you want a very quick 2 minutes on this since you were out of the room? Is that enough? Representative Cornish presented your case, which I'm not sure that you approve of that.
Now you're worried.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know how to pass Tony's eloquent argument. I know in the present time, I'll just simply say the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association opposed this bill, usurpation of police officer authority, and they're also concerned about some aspects of the bill as far as assumptions that are going to be made that, as expressed to us by members of the Minneapolis Police Department, about how this money will actually ever get accounted for or be attributed to the accounts that they're talking about. And with that, I'd stand for any questions.
Representative Kamer.
That was what my question dealt with, for Representative Thiessen. I was under the, and I could have this totally wrong, and I don't remember the rank of the Minneapolis.
Yes.
The question is really to you. Is, I was under the impression when this bill was explained to me that the bulk of the fines were really going to the company that produces the cameras and maintaining those cameras. So tell me if I'm wrong on that.
I think that's incorrect, but maybe someone else is better situated.
Hello, I'm Lieutenant Greg Reinhart. I'm a lieutenant with Minneapolis Police. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the fine structure in Minneapolis, it varies from city to city, but it technically costs $142, whether you go through a red light, you jaywalk, or whatever traffic ticket you get. Of that, 63% goes to the state. 67% goes to the city, or 37% goes to the city. When we put this program in place, we contracted a vendor to provide services. I signed a contract approximately $1 million a year to the vendor to provide services for a fixed rate service. So whether one ticket or whether a million tickets were issued, the price of the contract services would be the same. That way the vendor did not have a vested interest in how many tickets were issued. Now in the Minneapolis case, we had a contract of $1 million. That's not the bulk of the 25,000 tickets that were issued, and of those that were paid, the bulk of the money went to the state. The rest went to the city, and of course we paid our contractor out of it. It was about a 50-50 split of what monies were left between the vendor and for the city of Minneapolis. Of the monies that were left with the city of Minneapolis, they were redirected into public safety.
Thank you. I have one real quick question, Representative Thiessen. I support your bill, and I almost got in an accident yesterday because some idiot in St. Paul pulled out on ran a stop sign. I think this does provide a deterrent. But I thought that the courts ruled that this your bill was unconstitutional.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, they ruled it unconstitutional under Minnesota's uniformity provision. So the Minneapolis ordinance exceeded Minnesota state statute. By doing this, that constitutional issue is alleviated. There was a piece of that uniformity ruling that had to do with the burden of proof. But that, again, only related not constitutionally, because this is a petty misdemeanor, but, again, to the uniformity issue. So the constitutional problem gets solved. It had to do with the ordinance as opposed to state statute.
Representative Tamer, back when you were parking next to me, I wish we would have had cameras in there so that I could prove when you took half my spot.
And the League of Minnesota Cities and the Metro Cities also support the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question for Mr. Gillespie. And Mr. Thiessen, Representative Thiessen might have to comment. But the question I have, does this statute necessarily say that you can't have local police reviewing these things? The ticket's not necessarily automatically going to go out, because it's my understanding that people who follow had it, which they did, they may have done some checking on their own to make sure that the ticket should exist. Does it stop community enforcement entirely if you want to do some checking? I'm not saying you will, because quite frankly, you might not have time.
Mr. Chairman, actually, what that is the concern expressed to us by the officers in Minneapolis was the fact that there would be no checking, that what this is a civilization of the police authority, and that what they will do is civilians will review the tapes and then they'll hand it to an officer who has collateral duties of looking at this, and a rubber stamp will simply bang out the approval on these one after the other, and there won't be that sort of introspection that an officer brings to a traffic stop, and the opportunity to really be a violator to plead his case in the courts of street law and have some reason as to what happened. Most violators of traffic signals don't willingly run the red light. They're talking on the cell phone, or they're in a hurry, or they are absent-minded and miss it, or the sunlight's in their eye, or whatever reason that you want to get. That's what they're concerned about, is the fact that discretion is usurpated by the use of the electronic recording device.
Thanks. I just had a comment, Mr. Chair. Members, I heard about this when I was Chris Coleman's legislative aide on the St. Paul City Council. We were looking at it, and he kind of thought it might be a good idea. So as his legislative aide, I was looking into it. Well, since then, I really had problems with the Big Brother aspect of it, and especially as a prosecutor, too, in terms of proof and how we prove it. That said, I told Representative Thiessen I'd vote for his bill for several reasons. One, I don't know how you get the genie back in the bottle on this technology stuff. This thing's going to keep coming at us, people. I don't know if it's cameras now, it's going to be something else next, and we have to find a way to effectively manage it. And I saw my job as, somehow stemming the acceleration of the use of this technology, which may or may not be abrogating people's rights. But I thought the compromise language, 2 years sunset, not on the record, was good enough for me to take a look at it and see how we managed it. And I also know, a lot of people know this, but I was driving through Virginia and found out, they can't use radar in Virginia. Police can't. So what they do is, you got the bear in the air floating over the highway, who's clocking you with a stopwatch, which becomes extraordinarily expensive. I mean, really, really expensive to do. That's why I'm supporting it, and I hope over a 2-year examination period on this, we can see whether or not it's cost effective and also takes care of some of the other problems I brought up.
Representative Holmer, can we start to wind this up?
Yeah, I just have a question about in the past, we have, the state of Minnesota has gotten in trouble, and this may be for Representative Keith and the author. The state of Minnesota has gotten in trouble for shielding driving records, and in fact, we have been threatened by the feds that they won't offer any commercial driver's license unless we fix these things. And with the Dimmler Amendment that seals speeding between 55 and 65, and Representative Keith isn't paying attention, so I don't know why I'm even bothering with my question, but...
I have information. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Polver. I have information here that this is not the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration's Minnesota office states that this would fall outside of the scope of masking.
It would fall outside of that scope.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it had those that I mentioned about the correction.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, real quickly, the on page 2 of the bill, if the legal eagles could follow along with me here, on and see if this is in your intention, Representative Thiessen, on lines 2.8, you've got police authority. That's a kind of an archaic term. If you put that in there, all it's going to apply to is police. And each one of those, I think there's numerous pages throughout there, it should be peace officer authority. Police is doesn't apply to anything anymore as far as authority as peace officer under 626 definition, and that's sprinkled throughout the total bill. On lines 2.12, you've got local police authority. You should probably have law enforcement authority instead of police authority. The again on 2.27, 2.28.
Also. You're also on the division, and if this bill makes it there, I think you could point out we could make those corrections in that division.
And I agree. And then in general theme, then, if you want to make sure that this money gets to the law enforcement agency under fines on 3.16, you've got local authority participating. That there's a lot of definitions in statute on local road authority, local authority. It doesn't really define where that money is going to. And then 3.23, you've got public safety funding. Public safety now even includes all sorts of people. The security at Walmart is driving around the vehicles that say public safety on them. So you need to take a look at the whole bill and find out where the money is going, the accountability. If you give it to the city council, that's not one hint of a hope that it's going to get to the top. So that's just some of the problems I got with the bill.
Okay, Representative Pema renews his motion. This would have to go to local government, so all in, and then eventually to finance. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
No.
The meeting is adjourned.